Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
This Sunday, the deadlocked Democrats.
It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks. We're going to get it done.
President Biden delays the vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill as progressive and moderate Democrats fail to agree on social spending.
I'm telling you, we're going to get this done.
Progressives hold firm on their social policy bill.
I have consistently said that we need a vote in the Senate.
Moderates push back on the price tag.
I'm not asking them to change. I'm willing to come from zero to 1.5.
Even as they agree, both bills must pass.
We all have one common vision. Failure is not an option.
My guest this morning, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and senior White House advisor Cedric Richmond. Plus, Facebook under fire.
Facebook knows that its services are actively harming young children.
For reportedly hiding research showing its Instagram platform is harmful to teenagers. I'll talk to tech journalist and co-host of the podcast Sway, Kara Swisher, and one of the lead reporters on the Wall Street Journal's Facebook Files series, Jeff Horwitz. Also, Afghanistan fallout.
I recommended that we maintain 2,500 troops in Afghanistan.
Top military leaders say President Biden rejected advice to leave some forces in Afghanistan.
Did these officer and General Miller's recommendations get to the president personally?
Their input was received by the president.
But forcefully pushed back against Republican demands that they resign. Joining me for insight and analysis are Wall Street Journal columnist Peggy Noonan, former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and Jake Sherman, founder of Punchbowl News. Welcome to Sunday. It's Meet the Press.
From NBC News in Washington, the longest-running show in television history, this is Meet the Press with Chuck Todd.
Good Sunday morning. Well, at least Congress made sure the government didn't shut down. But that's not all that didn't happen this past week. Democrats with slim majorities and big differences of opinion did not manage to pass either of their two big priorities. Moderate Democrats wanted to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill and keep negotiating on the progressives' larger social spending wish list. That didn't happen. Progressive Democrats wanted more certainty on that social spending bill before voting for the infrastructure bill. And that didn't happen. Here's what did happen. President Biden traveled to Capitol Hill, told both sides their two priorities are now linked, which is just what progressives wanted to hear, and that the infrastructure bill will have to wait for an agreement on the larger social spending bill. Mr. Biden's decision left moderates feeling betrayed and progressives feeling emboldened because their stay strong approach had been validated at the highest level. It may still take weeks to get this done. The gamble now for Democrats is by delaying a sure thing that everyone wants, that bipartisan infrastructure bill, they risk getting nothing and having nothing to offer voters next year.
It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks. We're going to get it done.
President Biden putting his popular bipartisan trillion-dollar infrastructure bill on hold after a rebellion by progressives.
Everyone wants these roads and bridges, but people aren't going to remember a road the way they will remember if they wake up in the morning and they now have childcare so they can go back to work.
We need a vote. We need to be real. Are we going to deliver universal pre-K to this country or not?
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had promised to call a vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill on Monday.
Bring the bill to the floor tomorrow for consideration.
Then again on Thursday.
We'll have your vote today.
But put it off on Friday for a third time without the votes to pass it.
Speaker Pelosi, will there be a vote today?
When we had the votes.
The decision was a blow to the party's moderate wing.
Is this a setback for the president's agenda and the Democratic agenda?
If we get it done, it'll be a victory. The question is, when do we get that victory?
New Jersey Congressman Josh Guttheimer, a moderate, criticized Pelosi, saying she breached her firm public commitment to bring the bill up for a vote in September and lashed out at a small, far-left faction of the House.
Everybody's frustrated. It's part of being in government.
The president told House Democrats in a closed-door meeting on Capitol Hill to lower the price tag to between $1.9 and $2.3 trillion, closer to what West Virginia Senator Manchin is demanding.
My top line has been 1.5 because I believe in my heart that what we can do and what the needs we have right now and what we can afford to do without basically changing our whole society to an entitlement mentality.
Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema, another wild card, has privately said she will not support corporate or income tax rate increases. On Saturday, she called the two-track process an ineffective stunt.
We could bring the moderates and progressives together very easy if you had two more votes.
Yeah.
Two.
Progressives say even a smaller bill must address their priorities: housing, climate change, child care, elder care, and paid family leave, immigration, and a Medicare expansion.
We need to have a way to verify that whatever we agree to does not get delayed and does not get changed.
Biden campaigned on his ability to bring people together and deliver, contrasting his pragmatism with opponent Bernie Sanders in the primary.
Can you get it done? Have you ever done anything big? Have you ever been able to put together coalitions?
Now, he is being challenged to make good on that promise.
Why is the party 50-50? Come on, man. Unite the party, 50-50. I got it.
And joining me now is Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. He's, of course, the chair of the Senate Budget Committee. Senator Sanders, welcome back to Meet the Press, sir.
My pleasure.
Let me start with what apparently the president said behind closed doors to the House Democrats, and he floated the idea that, hey, this number is going to be a little bit lower, $1.9 trillion to $2.2 trillion. Have you accepted the fact that it's not going to be $3.5 trillion?
Chuck, that is, by the way, that is not my understanding of what he said. What he said is there's going to have to be give and take on both sides. I'm not clear that he did bring forth a specific number. But what the president also said, and what all of us are saying, is that maybe the time is now for us to stand up to powerful special interests who are currently spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to prevent us from doing what the American people want. We want to lower substantially prescription drug costs in this country so we're not paying 10 times more for certain drugs than Canada and other countries. And the pharmaceutical industry has 1,400 lobbyists on Capitol Hill right now trying to stop us. We want to deal with the existential threat of climate change. We want to deal with child care. We want to expand Medicare so elderly people can chew their food, can have hearing aids, can have eyeglasses. And we can pay for this by demanding that the wealthiest people and largest corporations finally start paying their fair share of taxes. That's what this struggle is about. Do we do what the American people want? Do we fulfill what democracy is supposed to be about? Or do we bow down to powerful special interests?
What is your preference when you're writing this bill? Look, I know what your initial preference was. You believe $3.5 trillion is the compromise, that you started at $6 trillion. But whatever the number ends up being agreed upon, do you believe in these programs? Because there's a large wish list and a set of needs the country has, but you might not be able to do all of them fully funded. Do you believe in trying to do as many of them as you can, and maybe that some of them are smaller programs, and you'll vote on them in a couple years to extend the funding? Or do you think you got to do three or four things really well?
Chuck, this is not a wish list. Climate change and cutting carbon emissions has everything to do with whether or not we leave this planet to future generations that is healthy and is habitable. Scientists tell us we got a few years. You want more workers out in the workforce, we need to reform childcare so that a million women can come back to work and not have to pay as a family 20 or 30% of their income for childcare. You have to have skilled workforce. We can't have a skilled workforce and do the good jobs that are out there unless we train young people. That's why we want to make community colleges tuition free. So this is not a wish list. This is what the working families of this country want and what the economy needs. The real question is, the Republicans, of course, are owned by the pharmaceutical industry and the fossil fuel industry. We don't expect them to do anything. But the question now is whether the Democrats can come together, and I think that we can, to finally do what working families in this country desperately want us to do.
You know, I'm curious, when one of the things that we've observed here in our news division is We know we're going to be closer to a deal when we see you and Senator Manchin in the same room with the president. And I'm curious, Senator Schumer apparently had a memo that had the number that Senator Manchin was basically his beginning negotiating number. Was that news to you, or have you known this for a couple of months where Senator Manchin stood on his red lines?
Well, Senator Manchin has, in fact, been public about talking. I think his number was $1.5 trillion. That's fine. That's a good negotiating start. Manchin has also said that he wants it paid for. I want it paid for. And you can pay for it with a $3.5 trillion bill by finally demanding that the wealthiest people in large corporations start paying their fair share of taxes. As you well know, Chuck, there's a given year when Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, the wealthiest people in this country, don't pay a nickel in federal income taxes. Large corporations don't pay a nickel. We address that. You could pay for a $3.5 trillion. You could pay for a $6 trillion bill and pay for it completely.
Yeah, I understand that. But was this a number you knew? Because a lot of people are wondering, hey, why are we waiting till this week to start these negotiations when apparently some of these, we knew Senator Manchin's starting number in July. It just felt like a lot of time was wasted.
Well, no, that's not accurate. I mean, there has been serious negotiations going on literally for months now. And, you know, there is a frustration that it has taken this long. I think I voted for the infrastructure bill. I think it's important that we rebuild our roads and our bridges and our water systems. That's very, very good. But it is absolutely imperative that we have a strong and comprehensive reconciliation bill, which finally addresses the needs of working families. So, you know, our job right now is to rally the American people to continue the negotiations. And I think at the end of the day, we're going to pass both pieces of legislation.
I want to talk about this issue of having them both linked together. I want you to react to what Senator Kyrsten Sinema said yesterday. Arizonans and all everyday Americans expect their lawmakers to consider legislation on the merits rather than obstruct new jobs and critical infrastructure investments for no substantive reason. What Americans have seen instead is an ineffective stunt to gain leverage over a separate proposal. She's referring to what happened in the House and the delay of that vote as a stunt. You were very supportive of the decision to hold off supporting that bill until everything was agreed upon. What do you say to Senator Sinema and to other moderates who don't like the linking of these two bills that think it sort of sends a message of dysfunction to the rest of the country?
No, it's not a message of dysfunction, and I'm sure you remember. From the very beginning of this process, the President of the United States, Speaker Pelosi, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, made it clear. We're going down this road in a dual way. Both bills have got to be linked together because there is a strong feeling on the part of many of us that if you just pass the infrastructure bill, which is a good bill, I voted for it, then we will not get to the bill that working families really want. That finally demands that the wealthiest people in this country start paying their fair share of taxes. So what we said is, look, we all want the infrastructure bill. Great. But we also have got to do the reconciliation bill, which addresses the long neglected needs of working families and the elderly. You know, expanding Medicare to cover dental, hearing aids and eyeglasses, doing child care, doing community colleges, enormously important for working families.
You made it clear that, and I think there is a path for you and Senator Manchin to find it. To find a path to get to meet somewhere, whether that's the middle, if somebody can define the middle, because you do agree on a philosophy on how to pay for this on those taxes. Are you close on with Senator Sinema, or is that, do you feel like you're farther apart in getting her agreement on this?
Well, there are a lot of people who are negotiating with Senator Sinema. She has been in the White House, as I understand it, on numerous occasions. I think the people of Arizona are beginning to stand up and show some impatience there and saying, you know, Senator, join the team here. Let's get something done on reconciliation. So I think, look, you know, sometimes, Chuck, in all due respect, the media thinks this is the Red Sox playing the Yankees. It is not. This is a long and complicated process, which is dealing with the most consequential piece of legislation probably since the New Deal and the Great Depression. It's a big deal. And it's not going to happen overnight. And the president is absolutely right. It doesn't matter whether it's next week or 3 weeks from now. What matters is that we finally address the problems facing working families. That's what matters.
Well, I was just going to say, deadlines are all artificial in your mind right now?
Of course they are. What matters is that we do it and we do it well. And when we do both of these pieces of legislation, I think the American people are going to say, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Democrats in the Congress. And by the way, where the hell were the Republicans in not having the guts to stand up to powerful special interests?
Senator Bernie Sanders, the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, the independent senator from Vermont who caucuses with the Democrats. Appreciate you coming on and sharing your perspective.
Thank you very much.
And joining me now is Cedric Richmond. He's the senior advisor to President Biden. Mr. Richmond, welcome back to Meet the Press. I should also note, as a former member of Congress, you obviously know quite a bit about what's going on in the Democratic conference there as well. So welcome back to Meet the Press.
Thanks for having me, Chuck.
Let me just start with some basics here. Where are we? And let me ask it this way. When the president acknowledged that these bills have to be passed together, maybe it wasn't his initial preference, but he's acknowledging the reality now. He also seemed to indicate that the number, the overall social spending number is going to come down to somewhere between 1.9 and 2.2 trillion. Is that where we are?
I'm not exactly sure in terms of the number. And we don't talk about it in terms of the number. We talk about it in terms of the needs that we need to meet for the people, in terms of the child tax credit, in terms of making sure that we bring health care costs down, in terms of prescription drugs, making sure that we make it more affordable. So we'll continue to do what we did with the American Rescue Plan, and that is to make sure we're meeting the needs of the American people. And then at the end of the day, we see what that adds up to. And here, in this case, we'll see how many of the needs that we can build consensus around and meet.
I am curious of that philosophically. There is a bit of a divide. I heard somebody refer to it as the appetizer strategy, meaning this. You try to do a lot of programs, and maybe if you can't fund them as fully as you wanted to, maybe they're shorter term. You create cliffs and you sort of see what sticks. Another philosophy says, no, do three or four programs really well. What is the philosophy of the president?
Well, we will consult with Congress. Congress plays a big role in how this will ultimately look. But we've been clear from the start that we wanted to cut taxes for over 50 million American families, that we wanted to bring down the cost of health care, and that we wanted to finally address the climate change and make sure that we're fighting for our future. And we're going to do that by making sure that the wealthy and big corporations pay their fair share. Working families have been doing it for a very long time.
All right. But you're evading, obviously, specifics here. I get it. You don't want to negotiate in public. But is there some non-starters here? I mean, are there some programs that have to be included, no matter whether it's $1.5 trillion or $3.5 trillion?
Well, no, I won't get into red lines on TV. The president has made clear his red line, which was he was not willing to raise taxes on anyone who made less than $400,000. And so that's our red line. And we're going to work with Congress to make sure we meet the challenges. So I just went down a list of programs that are very important that we want to meet. And we're going to continue to meet with people until we get it done.
Do you think relations with Senator Sinema are still good faith? And I say that because here was her statement yesterday. Good faith negotiations, however, require trust. Over the course of this year, Democratic leaders have made conflicting promises that could not all be kept, and have at times pretended that differences of opinion within our party did not exist, even when those disagreements were repeatedly made clear directly and publicly. She has indicated that there isn't enough trust in the Democratic Party. What do you say to her?
There's enormous amount of trust in the Democratic Party. But more importantly, there's a lot of focus on the American families. And look, people will be disappointed. People will not get everything they want. That is the art of legislating. But the goal here is to get both bills. And we're going to fight until we get both bills. And that's the statement from the president. Mm-hmm. Human infrastructure is important and physical infrastructure is important. So we're going to do both.
There was news this week to the public that Joe Manchin's bottom line was $1.5 trillion. Yet apparently he gave that number to Senator Schumer in July and apparently to President Biden quite a while ago. A lot of progressives, that was news to them on Wednesday or Thursday. Why is that? Why did it seem as if they were complaining that, hey, tell us what you want? And it turned out Manchin did. So did this unnecessarily delay negotiations?
No, when you ask, what do you want? Remember, we're not talking about this in terms of a number. We're talking about this in terms of the programs that meet the needs of the American people. So when we say, what do you want? Do you want child care? Do you want elder care? Do you want paid leave? Do you want to bring down the cost of prescription drugs? Do you want to expand Medicaid? Do you want to give tax breaks to working families in this country? When we say, what do you want? That's what we mean. And so our job is to bring people together, shape this in terms of the needs that we're going to meet. And then we'll see what a price tag is. We'll see where we end up. We'll see how long the programs will be in existence until they have to be renewed. That's how we're going to approach it. This is not about a number, because at the end of the day, here's what's important, Chuck. The number is zero. We are paying for everything in this piece of legislation. And it's very popular with the American people that the wealthy and big corporations finally pay their fair share. So we're going to pay for everything we do. So it's not arbitrary numbers. The number is zero.
All right. When is the new deadline? We know Congress doesn't act without deadlines. Do you going to get the debt ceiling and then you're going to try to get this done? Is it by the end of October? Is it Thanksgiving? Or is there no deadline?
Unfortunately, Chuck, we both know that Congress works better when there are hard deadlines. But with the debt ceiling, we're going to keep our head down. We're going to work, and we're going to work on the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill all at the same time. We can do it. This administration has been counted out over and over. If we go back to the American Rescue Plan and others, you'll see it. But here's what's important. The real question is, why are Republicans making us go at everything alone? We had to do the American Rescue Plan alone, which created more jobs than any administration in our history, which has increased our economic growth better than anybody in the last 4 years. We're going to have to be the mature party, responsible party, and keep us from going off of the debt cliff and ruining the economy and knocking everybody's retirement down, raising the cost of cars and interest and all of those things. Why do we have to keep going at it alone? But the good news is we do have a united Democratic Party. We're always going to put people and purpose first, not politics, and we're going to get it done.
Well, it sounds like after a long September, it may be a long October. Cedric Richmond, senior advisor to President Biden, appreciate you coming on and sharing the administration's perspective.
Thank you.
When we come back, will Democrats be rewarded if they deliver on both bills, or will they lose their gamble and end up with nothing to offer voters? Pamela's next.
The countdown to the Paris Olympics is on. Hi, everybody. It's Savannah Guthrie.
And I'm Hoda Kotb from the Today Show. We are so excited to kick off our celebration.
Yeah, this week, before the world gathers in the City of Light, today is bringing its magic of Paris to the plaza.
And Wednesday, it's just 100 days to go. Team USA hopefuls and champions will be taking over all morning for a huge party.
It's going to be epic, so join us this week on NBC.
Because today is where the games begin.
Join Hoda Kotb for a brand new season of her podcast, Making Space.
For season 5, I am making space to talk to people who are providing a sense of hope and inspiration when life changes course.
Uplifting conversations with inspiring individuals like NFL legend Drew Brees, singer-songwriter Ziggy Marley, and Today Show co-anchor Savannah Guthrie as you have never heard her before.
I found faith more viscerally, not because the bad thing didn't happen, but because it did.
I promise you, like me, will leave these conversations with some wisdom for your own journey, empowered and inspired to make space in your own life.
New episodes of Making Space with Hoda Kotb are released every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Panelists here. Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Jake Sherman, a founder of Punch Bowl News. Former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson. And Wall Street Journal columnist Peggy Noonan. All right, Mr. Sherman, this is you're the creature of the Hill as far as this panel is concerned. Both Bernie Sanders and Cedric Richmond said this is not about a number. They said it multiple times. Let me ask you, if this is not about a number, then why don't we have a deal?
It's about a number. I think, listen, I think that everybody is trying to figure out what the number is, what could fit inside that number, and what they could do. I mean, I think what you're seeing is the fact that this is a generational piece of legislation. I mean, Pelosi called it, and we're next to the Pelosiologist here, the culmination of her career. She said everything she's been building up to for 30 years in public office, more than that, is in this legislation. So people are taking it seriously. And every side is doing what they can. This is like a great example of power politics. Mm-hmm. Every side is doing what they can to gain as much leverage against the other side to achieve the end they're trying to achieve.
Susan, Speaker Pelosi rarely blinks. And the progressives made her blink.
And they made her blink. And, you know, here, and of course, when you go back to the Affordable Care Act, which was a comparable big victory, let's assuming she gets a victory here, but it was the last kind of big victory where she faced seemingly really difficult odds. The liberals, the progressives blinked on things like the public option. Yeah. And they did not blink this time. I think there are two reasons. There are more of them. Mm-hmm. And they are willing to risk getting nothing as opposed to accepting half a loaf. And that has changed the political landscape here.
Jay Johnson, there's, and I know people hate this phrase, the conventional wisdom. Right?
Yes, right.
But our friends at the New York Times put it, okay, Biden sided with the left. Now, I said this to the White House, and the White House would say it was just political reality of getting a bill passed. They don't accept the idea that they sold the moderates out. But some view it that way.
Well, let's not forget that the bill the progressives are pushing for is Biden's bill. It's his domestic agenda.
He wrote it, right.
It's not as if it's some wild-eyed, far-left socialist piece of legislation. This is Joe Biden's Build Back Better domestic agenda, and the progressives are carrying his water on Capitol Hill and appear to be doing it rather effectively right now. And so I personally believe that there's going to be a deal at some point.
They can't not have a deal, right?
Yes, like,
I think that's what a bunch of us looking at. I don't know how they get their
deal. Whether it's 3.5, 2.5, 2.75, who knows? But there will be a deal because they can't walk. None of them can walk away empty-handed.
You know, Peggy, though, Susan brought up health care. And I've been thinking about health care. I remember when the deadline was the August recess. And then the deadline was the end of September. Then it was Thanksgiving. Then it was Christmas Eve. And then, you know, it was March. And we got to the point where the process so dominated that the legislation never had a chance to get sold to the American public.
Yeah.
At what point did the Democrats fall into that trap with the process consuming the substance?
I think this, however long this struggle or disarray or whatever it is takes, the worse it looks. I think these two bills now squished into sort of one initiative, I think with the mess around it and with the sense that the progressive caucus and the progressives are in charge, they're driving this, they're the face of this, I think in a very broadly public way in America, that does not look good and it becomes a little bit poisonous. I mean, I think when you move on something as big as 3.5 plus 1.2 for the infrastructure, you're talking about big things. You ought to have some sort of mandate behind you.
Yeah.
They've got a 50-50 Senate, a close House. Joe Biden was not elected in mandate territory. So I don't understand what they're doing. It seems to me that a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, it's popular. Pass it. Take the win. Beyond that, you have a separate bill. Tease out the most popular things. Take those wins. I don't get the maximalist attitude at all.
I'm guessing you may have like been eavesdropping on Terry McAuliffe's phone calls. Because I say this because at a debate earlier this week, I asked Terry McAuliffe about the 3.5 price tag. He took the opportunity, Jake, to take after everybody in Congress. Take a listen.
I think the 3.5 is too high.
Do you?
Sure. But here's my message to Congress. I am really sick and tired of all of them. They got to stop their little shitty chat up there, and it's time for them to pass it. Let's get this infrastructure bill passed for America.
30 seconds. We teased this show about 22, but the canary in the coal mine about the Democratic Party's position in America is in a month.
Yeah, I think, listen, it's an easy battering ram to just say, you know, Congress is bad and everybody will agree with Congress being bad and not being able to do this. But listen, I think that this is what Josh Gottheimer and the moderates are saying, right? Give this guy a victory. Give Joe Biden a victory. He needs it now. His poll numbers are down. He just had a really difficult withdrawal from Afghanistan, to say the least. Give this president, our president, the Democratic president, a victory. That's what the moderate Democrats are saying.
And here's why they're not doing that is because they think this is the last train leaving the station.
That's what I was wondering here.
That's the risk. This is why everything's been piled into this reconciliation bill, because there is entirely possible possible. That is the last chance to get a big piece of Democratic legislation through before we are completely overtaken by the midterm.
The reality, the psychology driving a lot of this is the fear that a four-year presidency or a two-year Congress is really only 1 year to get big.
Oh, they're acting like it. There's no clear.
It's probably true.
And it's really, it's not even a year. It's a month. Mm-hmm. to get big stuff done. So what happens is 95% of the people's business all gets done at the 12th hour.
You know, this is the issue. There's no second bite at the apple. And guess what? Look back the last 30 years. Nobody's gotten a second bite at the apple. George W. Bush got to do one big thing. That was it. Obama. Oh, I would argue there hadn't been a second bite. So history says.
We're 9 months into this administration. A series of smaller bills that you can pass one after another. Start giving a sense of momentum,
which Congress can do that?
I forget which one did, but they can do it, damn it.
In our lifetime, how about that?
Well, so Jake, how does this end, and is there a new deadline? I heard Bernie Sanders, no deadline. We joked about what happened with health care. Is the end of the year unreasonable at this point?
No, I think that's the story that we're looking at. I would also say that the health care law was passed over 10 months. And what Pelosi's trying to do is she's trying to pass this bill, or what Congress is trying to do, in a really compressed time period. I mean, they really didn't get started until the summer. And they're trying to do it in 4 or 5 months, and that's difficult. I do think something gets done. I think it's going to be really messy. I would say that October 30th, or the end of the month, is going to be a deadline because there's a highway funding that needs to be refreshed. Congress just refreshed it on Friday night, yeah. But they could refresh it again.
There is a deadline. And of course, they can also decide that the day of the week never ends, mm-hmm.
yes.
as they did. They can
yes.
always keep
I don't
a day
buy that, but
longer
yes.
than 24 hours if necessary. When we come back, Facebook under fire for everything from Instagram on teens to January 6th. That's next. Welcome back. Facebook is under fire on a number of fronts right now. Last week, politicians from both parties condemned Facebook, accusing it of hiding research that shows how harmful Instagram, its platform, can be for teenage girls. In fact, the Wall Street Journal reported, for instance, that one Instagram research slide said, "We make body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teen girls." But Facebook's problems go well beyond what's going on at Instagram. The New York Times reports that the same Facebook whistleblower who has been giving research to the Wall Street Journal is accusing Facebook of easing some security safeguards shortly after the election, and that it ended up helping to incite the January 6th riot. This whistleblower will reveal her identity tonight, and she is scheduled to testify before Congress on Tuesday. So joining me for more on all of this is Jeff Horwitz. He's one of the Wall Street Journal reporters who's been reporting on Facebook under their umbrella Facebook Files. And Kara Swisher, a tech journalist and co-host of the podcast Sway. Welcome to both of you. I should mention, we asked Facebook to provide us with a guest, and they declined. Jeff, I want to start with this and what we're going to hear tonight and next week from this whistleblower. But it seems as if whether it's what you've been reporting on what they did in research of Instagram, or the elite group, or sort of the fact that elite Facebook users got treated differently than normal Facebook users. This is coming from inside of Facebook. How under siege are they as a company right now?
So we have heard that they actually have taken pretty much all of their researchers and basically blamed them for this. It's a very weird mentality over there. They have been kind of throwing those people under the bus, the people that they asked to understand the platform's role in the world. And that's a very kind of aggressive thing for them. I think the memo that Nick Clegg sent out internally mm-hmm. is kind of remarkable. You are basically telling your own staff that your company can't be blamed for, as the primary cause, that was the language, for polarization in America. Mm-hmm. And that, everyone should be proud to work there. But nonetheless, this does feel like a pretty remarkable couple of weeks for them internally.
I'm going to put up a piece of that, Kara. Here's what Nick Clegg's statement, just a part of it, said. The suggestion that is sometimes made that the violent insurrection in January 6th would not have occurred if it was not for social media is so misleading. Mature democracies in which social media use is widespread hold elections all the time. For instance, Germany's election last week without the disfiguring presence of violence.
Yeah.
I have to say, I was jarred by the phrase mature democracies.
Right.
Are we not?
Yes.
What is Facebook trying to do?
Well, what they're trying to do is do word games, and he's excellent at them, by the way. I think they should give him a raise in that regard. But he's saying they're the primary. Look at the individual words they use. This is typical of Facebook. They've done it for decades now, or not decades, a decade now, where they use tiny words. No one's accusing them of being the primary reason for polarization. Humanity has been awful for centuries now, that kind of thing. And so what they're doing is they're saying, we didn't cause hate. I don't think they did. What they're doing is amplifying and weaponizing it to an unprecedented degree.
Jeff, you've been getting all of this research from this whistleblower. There's two ways to look at what Facebook is doing. They're, on one hand, you could say, well, they're doing the research. That's good. On the other hand, they're not telling us about it. Now, they're going to argue, well, we're doing this research so we can make safer products. But are they doing all this research after the fact? It does seem as if they launch a product first, see what the problem is, and then they do some research to see if they can fix it. Is that the problem at Facebook? They sort of have this all backwards?
Yeah. I mean, that has been for years the standard way, which is you roll it out, you hope for the best, and if it doesn't work out well, then, yeah, maybe you try to mitigate. And at that point, you study the product and perhaps see if you can make it better without harming the engagement and growth-related reasons you did it in the first place. And if you can't, then you have a conflict. And I think a big reason for why this information has made it to me is that even when Facebook does discover problems and they are fixable, the company hasn't acted, according to a lot of the people who've been assigned to fix these issues.
How much of a divide do you think is inside of Facebook? Is this really the executives are out of touch and the rank and file are going?
I think what's happened is the employees are tossing documents over the wall to people like Jeff. You know, this is what's happening is they cannot. It's not tenable for a company. This is a company whose employees didn't really leak for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But you're seeing it all over tech. It's not just here. It's people are like, just a second, what we're doing is damaging. It's not, you know, I did an interview with Mark Benioff a couple of years ago. He called it cigarettes. It's not precisely cigarettes, is it? It's also gambling. It might be opiates. It might be other things. But the people inside those companies are recognizing that this company doesn't anticipate consequences and then tries to clean it up later and then not very well.
Jeff, they really hate the tobacco metaphor. Trust me, I heard this firsthand myself. The idea they're like, you know, we're not, you know, because they just don't accept the premise that social media is harmful, right? Cigarettes, no matter how you look at it, is potentially harmful. We now all agree with that. They don't accept that single premise, although some of us think maybe we should.
Look, the company has, Adam Mosseri actually, you know, sort of compared it to cars, not cigarettes. And I actually think that's a perfectly good example, which is that this is an industry. It was a fantastic technology, really a remarkable innovation. And it was not well designed initially. It was very poorly designed. And it took decades and decades of humanity figuring out how to live with it and how to incorporate it and how to, you know, include speed limits and seat belts and all these other things that kind of make it safer and make it so that it's just not a constant bloodbath. And I think Facebook is sort of resisting some of that. And one of the things that the person who is going to be speaking tonight will likely be talking about is they have had to impose break the glass measures, so emergency safety measures, three times in the course of basically 6 months, right after the election, right before, right around January 6th. Yeah. And then, you know, and by the way, in between those two times, they lifted them, right? I think right. That's a kind of an indication that this company doesn't have full control of the product is, you know, literally within a month, they had to reimpose them. And then again, with COVID vaccine misinformation in the spring. And so this is kind of it does feel like they are having a hard time keeping their product under control. Yeah. And they seem to not want to slow down.
And Kara, on the Congress front, we saw Richard Blumenthal, the senator from Connecticut, had this weird moment, didn't quite know what Finsta meant, which is a fake Instagram account.
It's not fake.
Well, meaning if you're impersonating your someone else, my daughter will say, I have a Finsta too.
Yeah.
But is Congress, do they have the ability to do this?
No, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of great legislators who completely understand the problem. Amy Klobuchar, Ken Buck. David Cicilline, there's dozens and dozens. This was just and even Richard Blumenthal understands. He's not a Luddite. This was just a silly thing. And that's what happens is this trope that Congress can't legislate. Well, you know, Richard Blumenthal is not a car expert and they can legislate or a finance expert. Everybody can be regulated. And we need smart legislation here to try to rein in some of this because clearly Facebook's not going to do it. And they're going to get defensive, which is what they're doing.
And it's one thing. Facebook has done something that the rest of us have been wondering. How do you do it? How do you unite both parties in Washington?
Yeah,
Facebook has done it. Kara Swisser, Jeff Horwitz, thank you both. When we come back, how climate change has dangerously lowered water levels in the West. Now that's already changing people's lives. That's next. Welcome back. We are thrilled to announce our streaming show, Meet the Press Reports, is back for a third season. Each week, we take a deep dive into a single issue. Here's a quick look at some of the topics we've already covered in the first two seasons.
I did not think I was racist. I thought that I saw a truth that no one else did.
Were you racist?
Absolutely.
Do you believe that we're at war on the internet right now?
We have serious infrastructure and water issues in this country.
How many people are at risk of an encounter with ICE?
Anybody that looks like this is at risk.
Anyone fears a long-term war.
People that have not had the opportunity to use whatever tools they have to change things now see that, hey, if there's an issue that I care about, I can do something about it.
And to kick off season three, we're focusing on climate change and the real ways Americans' lives are already being changed. My colleague Cal Perry took us down the Colorado River, where the federal government declared a water shortage for the first time ever, and water and power supplies to states in the West are at real risk. Here's a bit of his report.
This is a visual representation of climate change. We're here at Lake Mead, and just like Lake Powell, it's at its lowest level ever. As you can see, it's lost 140 feet of water in just 20 years. And the effect that it has on power is profound. The Hoover Dam, because of those low water levels, is currently operating at a quarter reduced capacity.
Talk to me about the importance of power and how the dam is important in that way.
As the lake goes down, less and less power is generated at the dam. And for every foot that the elevation drops, the capacity drops by roughly 5.5 megawatts.
That means each foot powers 4,000 to 6,000 American homes. Kristen Averett works as Nevada's state climate policy coordinator.
Did you sort of see this coming to this extent?
This is precisely the kind of thing that we've expected all along with respect to climate change. I will say it's visceral. And for those of us who have worked on this kind of issue for decades, it's really sad to see that it's actually here.
And that's the point. It's already here. You can see the rest of Cal's report and our full show right now on Peacock. Binge away. New episodes debut every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern time on NBC News Now. And then, of course, on Peacock the next day. When we come back, top military brass say they advise President Biden to keep 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. Would it have made a difference if the president had said yes to that? That's next.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. The other big story this week was the very blunt, I call it a blunt hearing we got from the Pentagon leaders on Capitol Hill. And there was some dispute between whether the military advisors, what advice did the military advisors give President Biden, and what did President Biden say his military advice, his military advisors give. Let's give you a little bit of a back and forth between what we heard from the president and what we heard from General McKenzie this week on Capitol Hill.
But your top military advisors warned against withdrawing on this timeline. They wanted you to keep about 2,500 troops.
No, they didn't. It was split. That wasn't true. That wasn't true.
I recommended that we maintain 2,500 troops in Afghanistan.
The idea that the Taliban would take over was premised on the notion that somehow the 300,000 troops we had trained and equipped was going to just collapse. They were going to give up. I don't think anybody anticipated that.
I've stated consistently that my position was, if you go below 2,500, you're going to look at a collapse of the Afghan military.
Jay Johnson, you worked in the Pentagon before you were at DHS. You worked for Secretary Gates. You were chief counsel, so you know how this building operates. I think the surprising thing to me this week was just how public now we know the split. Not, I don't think it's a personal split, but clearly a policy split on this withdrawal between our military leaders, both civilian and in uniform, and the president.
Well, the difference of opinion is not uncommon. I was a little surprised that in their testimony, the generals made no attempt to try to reconcile what they believed versus what the president said. But I kind of know where it comes from. When anyone is up for confirmation before the Senate Armed Services Committee, which includes all of the military, there's a questionnaire that they send the witness beforehand. And one of the questions is, do you promise that you will always tell us everything we want to know? And the 3 and 4 stars in the building take that very, very seriously. And so they answered the question very straightforward. You saw Lloyd, on the other hand, the civilian political appointee,
right.
say, well, I don't discuss my conversations with the president, which is what he's supposed to say. And it's called executive privilege. But the generals are, nope, that's, I told him this.
You know, Peggy, there's a part of this that we should all view as very healthy, right? That we can see that there's disagreement,
right.
there's civilian control, all of that stuff. But it does, the president made this decision. I'm surprised he didn't, in hindsight, own it more there in that interview.
The president looked dodgy. He looked dodgy in the original interview when he said essentially, no, nobody told me otherwise. And then he looked bad the other day with General Milley. I think probably he should have simply owned it and said, look, I was warned. This might be really hard. I decided we're going to go ahead anyway. Short, though, I think the generals right now, after 20 years of war, after seeing them, after whatever they've been through, they are really media savvy. They are really aware of press clippings. They are really aware of their big hunk of medals. I was looking at General Milley the other day, and I thought of Omar Bradley, General of the Army. Omar Bradley, a great man, helped win World War II. They had to remind him to put on his medals. He wanted to keep himself out of things, not in things. There's a kind of showbiz shift, I think, in the military that concerns me.
I want to bring up something else General Milley said, though, guys, because there is also an admittance here that this was a failure. Take a listen.
Although the NEO was unprecedented and is the largest air evacuation in history, was a tactical, operational, and logistical success evacuating 124,000 people. The war was a strategic failure.
This, to me, you know, we're sitting here talking about President Biden's credibility versus his military commanders. This undermines, to me, all the military commanders of the last 20 years. Strategic failure. How many people in uniform went up to Congress and said, oh, no, it's working. Oh, no, it's working. Please fund it. It's working. Now you tell us it's a failure?
You know, I thought that was chilling that 4 presidents, 4 administrations, a series of generals had told us, number one, that they understood what was going on in Afghanistan. Clearly, we didn't. And that they lied to the American people about the real true assessment about how things were going. And I thought that was the takeaway here. I was glad that they were candid about our failures in Afghanistan. I wish they had been candid, the generals that came before them, for the past 20 years.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's the accountability that's missing.
It's never as clear when you're in the thick of it. I know from personal experience. And it was inevitable that the Taliban was going to overrun the country. Once we went down the path of a 2-way deal versus a 3-way deal that required the Taliban and the government to come to some terms in power sharing. The Taliban used to say, you guys may have the watches, but we have the time.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened.
Jake, is this going to do any long-term damage to the military's ability to get what they want out of Congress? Military always gets what they want out of Congress. Is that going to change after this?
No, because what the military does is they say, we need this and we're not going to be safe unless we get this. And I think speakers of the House...
That happens to work, by the way.
And it does work. Right. It does work. But
we got a 20-year war in Afghanistan to prove it. That was fully funded.
And we have a $760 billion defense budget.
And speakers of the House and Senate majority leaders tend to defer to them.
It's pretty clear. That's all I have for today. I know you have one more thing to say, but I'm too tight on time. We'll read about it next week, I bet. Thank you all for watching. We'll be back next week, because if it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press.